Sound okay in the back? Raheem, can you hear me? Am I mumbling? Good? All right. So we have a really easy task this morning. We're just going to go through this whole thing, okay? Woo. So let's open up to page 1. Graham, can you start reading for us? Couple things. I was looking around today because I'm going to be flipping through the Bible a bunch of different places. And some of us have physical Bibles. A lot of us don't. And let me encourage us. I'm going to get on a soapbox here for just a second. I know a lot of us, you know, read the Bible on our phones, and so we feel like we can come to church and not really bring it. And that's fine. But let me encourage us for this next season, at least. Let's try to show up on Sunday mornings with the actual physical Bible. And if you don't have one, talk to one of us, and we'll find one for you. Funny story. Some of you know Rosie in ETC, the ETC neighborhood, a homeless woman. This was not like a year ago, maybe even a year and a half ago. I was missing a Bible, and I see her on the street, and she says, she would call me, I think, Pastor for a while. Pastor, the greatest thing happened to me. God has been so good to me. I said, that's great, Rosie. What happened? She goes, you never believe it, but I found a Bible. God just gave me a Bible. I said, that's great. And then she pulls out this Bible that I was missing. And I'm guessing I left it out at ETC and it got snagged during one of the homeless outreach. So if you don't have a Bible, we'll find one for you. It'll be fine. I didn't have the heart to tell her it was mine. I just said, that's so fantastic. So, but for the next season, let's actually have a physical Bible. And here's, in a really simple way, my argument for it. Our phones are not devoted objects. Our phones are used for email, for texting, for telephones, for note-taking, for all kinds of things. And our Bibles are used for one thing, if that makes sense. It's a kind of devoted object. And I think in the era of Kindle and in the era of iPhones, we've forgotten how to sort of focus on one thing. And I think there's a discipline or there's a gift, a means of grace would be sort of the traditional way of talking about it, and actually having a physical Bible. So there's my argument. For the next season, let's just try to bring one on a Sunday morning. Okay. To the sermon now. What would happen to you if Jesus appeared to you? Or, let me say it this way. If Jesus appeared to you tomorrow on your way to work, would you recognize him? If Jesus spoke to you in a dream, would you know it was his voice? If Jesus commanded you to do something, would you recognize it as his command? What if Jesus appeared to you, the resurrected Jesus? Would we recognize him? See, in the book of Revelation, if we open up to Revelation chapter 1, here John is stranded on an island. John, who had spent his entire, or not his entire life, but John, who had spent a good part of his adult life with Jesus, who knew Jesus through Jesus' ministry and then served Jesus after Jesus ascended to heaven. But John finds himself abandoned on an island. He finds himself a prisoner of Rome, without a Bible, without the Christian community, without people to sort of run things by. And then John has this vision, and it's a vision that's surprising, that's unexpected. He sees the resurrected Jesus, but not just the resurrected Jesus. He sees the resurrected Jesus as God himself. Nowhere in the Bible is the connection between Jesus as the Son of God as clear as it is in the book of Revelation. John sees something unexpected, and he recognizes it as Jesus. He hears a command from Jesus. Here in chapter 1, verse 17, "Do not be afraid. I am the first and the last." Jesus is making a claim that he is God. "I am the living one. I was dead, and behold, I am alive forever and ever, and I hold the keys of death and Hades." John sees and hears something maybe a little bit unexpected, and yet he instantly knows whose voice this is. And the rest of the book of Revelation is John reporting on what it is that Jesus is saying, what it is that Jesus, what he sees when he looks at Jesus. You see, John knew the biblical story. He knew the biblical story so well, he didn't need to have the scriptures in front of him. It was just a part of his, almost his body, a part of the way he saw the world and imagined the world. And he knew the biblical story so well that when Jesus comes and appears to him, he recognizes Jesus, and he has language to talk about what it is that he sees. Now, my kids know the Disney stories so well that they can often narrate the world in light of the world of Disney. Some of our children know the Star Wars trilogy so well that they can narrate the world according to Star Wars. Friends, as Christians, we're called to know and indwell and become a part of the biblical story in such a way that we narrate the world from the point of the Bible. So there's three questions I think we need to ask in terms of understanding what the biblical story is. The first one is, what kind of book is the Bible? Because before we actually talk about the story, we need to know what kind of a book it is. You see, I was raised in a setting where we thought of the Bible as a kind of storehouse of facts, or maybe a series of commands about how we should live in response to God. And so we spent lots of effort finding and underlying the in a sense, the law that's in the Bible. Do this and don't do that. And we would memorize it, and we would learn it. See, if the Bible is simply a series of commands for how we ought to live, if the Bible is a storehouse of facts, almost like a scientific textbook, then we would read it in a certain kind of way. We would look at it for certain kinds of information. And so we have all kinds of debates right now between science and religion and all these things. We get caught up in, ever since the Catholic Church kicked Galileo out because he said that the sun revolved around the earth rather than vice versa. We've looked at the Bible sometimes for the wrong sets of information and focused on the wrong kinds of things. But there's other approaches to the Bible that see it as ancient wisdom, only a book of ancient wisdom. And so it's the best of what humans have thought over the centuries. When we find ourselves in a bind, or we need to know how to get ahead in life, or we need a little pick-me-up, we go to the Bible and we get some information and we apply it. See, the problem with that viewpoint is the Bible becomes something selective. We largely live our lives as modern people, and then every once in a while we turn to the Bible when we get stuck, or we need a little pick-me-up, or we don't quite know the way forward on something. And perhaps we could go three or four other ways that people approach the Bible. But my point is these two are probably the extremes we tend to fall into. The Bible is a series of commands, a storehouse of facts. Or the Bible is simply a book of ancient wisdom that we turn to when we need a little bit of help. See, the problem with these kinds of approaches to the Bible is that we see the Bible as a book of information. The Bible is not a book to get us information. The Bible is actually a book that gives us a kind of formation. The Bible isn't something we turn to find out a bunch of stuff, although there's lots of stuff we can find out. Rather, the Bible is a book that gives us a lens through which we look so that we might recognize the presence and work of God in the world, so we might become the people that God has created us to be. And so what do we do when we want to form people rather than only inform people? We tell stories, largely. Stories are the way we make sense of the world. And stories are what cause us or help us to live in the world in a different kind of way. Let me give an example. So let's say your child comes to you and says, Mom, Dad, why do I need to go to school? What do you say back? What's the response? Why do you go to school? Wrong person to ask. Okay. Why do you go to school?
To learn things and make new friends.
Okay, to learn things and to make new friends. Why do we go to school?
Because I said so.
Because I said so. Okay.
To become a better person.
To become a better person.
Raheem. To get some kind of accreditation.
To get some kind of, why would you get some kind of accreditation? Why would you want to meet people? Why would you want to become a better person? What's the point of all this?
Responsibility.
Give your parents some rest at home. Okay, that's probably the real reason. Why do we want to learn responsibility? There's a bigger story here, isn't there? Yeah, so we can live in the world, so we can find our place in the world, right? We tell our kids, you go to school because going to school is the way that you become an adult. You learn what you need to learn. You meet the people you need to meet. You learn the skills that are going to carry you forward. What do we do when our kids ask us why we go to school is we tell them a kind of story. We give them a kind of narrative arc, right? This is the way the world is, kids. This is the way you live in it. You go to school so that you might become this. We could do the same with a whole bunch of other things that we do regularly that we just take for granted, like investment in retirement. Why do we put away money in retirement? Well, because we have a particular kind of story about the way things are, that our capitalist system, the free marketplace helps money to grow if you invest on money and if you invest smartly. And over time, it's going to grow over this percentage. It's a particular kind of story that makes it possible for us to live in a particular kind of way or to do specific things. You see, stories that are powerful and that cause us to live in the world in a different way are authoritative for us. We all live according to certain authoritative stories, certain frames or lenses that we just accept on faith. This is the way the world works. We go to school so that we might learn what we need to learn, so that we might become adults. We invest money so that we might have money when we retire. We can fill in the blank with any one of these other kinds of authoritative stories or frameworks that we live according to. But an authoritative story is also, in a sense, authorizing. So it's not just that it tells us the way the world works, but it tells us how we ought to live within the world. So one of the predominant authoritative and authorizing stories we have in North America is that anybody can get ahead if they just work hard enough, right? That kind of framework. And we all have examples in the back of our mind of people that have, you know, plugged away and been and persevered and gotten up every morning at 6 o'clock and put their time in, and before long they're a success. And so we tell those stories in order to, as authoritative, because this is the way the world works. If you work hard, you get ahead. But also as authorizing, in the sense that they tell us to live in this sort of way. Well, I think you can see where I'm going with this. See, the Bible, for us, is not just a nice kind of story. It's not just one among many. But for those of us who commit ourselves in faith to the risen Jesus, the God of the resurrection, the God of the Exodus, the God who created all that exists, for us, the Bible is the story. It's the authoritative story, meaning it tells us the way the world is. But it's also the authorizing story, in the sense that it invites us to live in a particular kind of way. It makes possible a way of life. It forms us. Not to be good capitalists or good educators or whatever, but to be the people of God. The Bible is the inspired, meaning the Holy Spirit has inspired those that wrote it. Authoritative and authorizing story about God and God's world. It tells us the way things are and invites us to live accordingly. The Bible gives us information, but it's not about that. It's about formation, so that we might live in the world in a different kind of way. It's our authoritative and our authorizing story. So the next question then is, what does the Bible actually say? And for this, I want to give us just kind of four hooks. We could spend, I mean, every time we get up and we preach or we do a study guide or we talk, we're getting at what the Bible says. But it's helpful to have in our minds the kind of narrative arc or the significant points of the biblical story so that no matter what part we turn to, we can kind of place it in context. So there's a lot of different ways we can do this. I want to give us four connecting points, four places in the Bible that almost give us the story in a nutshell, or give us, in a sense, different angles on the same story. So the big picture is that the Bible is the story of God's purpose and activity to renew all of creation. Again, it's not about information. It's not about what's happening in my soul. It's not about just kind of spiritual things and nothing else. The Bible is about God's purpose and activity to renew all of creation. And as a story, the main character in the Bible is always God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It's God before it's you and I. It's about God's purpose and activity for all of creation. And when we understand that, it opens up space for us to live in a different kind of way. So here's four connecting points, four different places we can turn to the Bible to sort of see the story in a nutshell. The first one is the very beginning, Genesis chapters 1 to 3. Genesis chapters 1, so go ahead and turn there. We're not going to read through it. We're just going to reference it. But Genesis chapters 1 to 3 is the creation story. And in the creation story, it says, in the beginning, God. And what makes the creation story significant and important is that here we have a picture of God creating, not out of need, not out of loneliness, not because he's angry. We have a picture of God simply speaking and creating, creating out of an abundance of love and generosity. In the beginning is God. And God said, and it was, and it was good. And when we get to the high point of creation in chapter 6, or I'm sorry, on day 6, we see God creating humanity. And he creates humanity in his image. And he calls humanity very good. And what it means to be created in his image is that he's created us for partnership, for working with him in the garden, for having dominion over the plants and the animals, for working alongside God in the care of all things. You see, at the very beginning is a picture of God creating out of love and wanting partnership with his creation. In a sense, God withdrawing to give us space so that we might flourish. The way that a parent loves their children into maturity, not by overshadowing them, but by creating space for them to flourish. Also in the creation story, though, is the fall in chapter 3. You see, humanity wasn't happy or wasn't settled in trusting in God. And so Adam and Eve rebel. And it changes the whole nature of things. What was once harmonious is now in conflict. And so in this first picture of creation, we see the character of God, but we also see the fallenness of humanity. And within the midst of that, God doesn't destroy creation, but rather God commits himself to work with it. A faithful God, a fallen humanity, and God's commitment to us, to making things right. The next touch-in point would be Exodus chapter 19. Now, the book of Exodus is in some sense it's the paradigm of God's saving work in the world. You see, in the midst of our fallenness and our sin, God selects a group of people who are slaves in Egypt, a group of people to whom he has promised himself, and he calls them and rescues them from Egypt. And then in verse 19, in chapter 19, verse 4, God tells Moses what this is about. He says, "You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation." You see, the second piece of the story is covenant. We have a holy God who creates out of nothing, who created humanity for the purpose of serving and partnering with God in caring for creation. Humanity has been unable to fulfill that, and so God creates a covenant. God commits himself. He, in a sense, doubles down. He commits himself to those who he has created. And out of all the nations of the earth, he takes this poor and lowly slave people, rescues them from Egypt, and gives them a law so that they might embody and enact and demonstrate the goodness of God. But the purpose of this, he says, "I made you a kingdom of priests." The purpose of this is not to make the Israelites special, but to save the whole world. See, a priest is a mediator between God and others. So God creates a covenant people, and he releases them to be a priest in the world, to be a go-between between God and the world, so that the whole world might be saved. And so in covenant, we see a faithful, loving, creative God who commits himself to a faithless, fickle people, who wraps his arms around them for the sake of healing the world. Now, from Exodus throughout the rest of the Old Testament is a story of Israel's struggle to fulfill their end of the covenant. You see, God commits himself to Israel, but Israel, like the rest of us, comes and goes in their level of commitment. And so there's a time of the judges where there's ups and there's downs. There's times where Israel's faithful and there's times where Israel goes after other gods. There's a time of the monarchy where Israel's kings. David starts out good and has a couple snags. Solomon starts out good and ends up worshiping many gods, and it really goes downhill after that. Israel's kings are unable to fulfill the kind of partnership that God requires of them, and Israel becomes just one nation among the rest. No longer looking like a covenant people. No longer good news to their neighbors. Wanting to be like the other nations. And so then there's exile, and there's the call and cry of the prophets for God to do something, for God to save his people yet again. And so the next touch-in point we have is Mark chapter 16. Now we're skipping a lot, but here in Mark chapter 15, verse 37. Here, this is the end of Jesus' life. And in the book of Mark, but in particular the book of Mark, but all throughout the Gospels, there's a clear connection that's made between recognizing Jesus as the Son of God and the cross. It's not until the cross that Jesus is sort of fully recognized as the Son of God. You see, there's creation where God demonstrates himself as faithful and loving. God creates us in his image to serve with him. There's covenant where God, in a sense, wraps his arms around us and commits himself to us to create a people that might redeem and reconcile the world. And then there's cross, when it becomes obvious that none of us can fulfill what God has requested. When it becomes obvious that all of the earth, there's not an adequate human partner. And so God sends his Son, who becomes the faithful partner on our behalf, and who goes all the way in identifying with us, even to death, so that now even the most God-forsaken place, our death, is claimed by God. And see, on the cross, we see not only that God is the creator, Not only that God chooses a people among the world to demonstrate who he is and what he's about, but we also see that God is the one who seeks out those far from him. God is the one who loves us even when we are enemies of him. God is the one who seeks out those who are not pure, who do not know the scriptures, who do not follow the things that he's written down. God goes to those that are God-forsaken and claims even them. And then the final piece of the story is in Mark chapter 16, when we see the resurrected Jesus, the consummation. See, God does not just go to death, but then God reverses death by rising again, by raising Jesus from the dead. And in chapter 16, it's not just that Jesus rose from the dead, but that Jesus says, "See, I go before you to Galilee. You're going to see me there." And as we follow the story, it's not just that he's in Galilee, but then he's out in front of them into Antioch. And then he's out in front of them to Rome. And then, you see, Jesus is alive. Jesus is risen. Which means there's something active that Jesus is doing in the world even now to bring the work that he started into completion. See, in creation, we see that God is the creator God, who out of love creates all that exists and sustains it, who created us in his image to be partners with him. In the covenant, we see that God claims a people in order to demonstrate to the world who he is and make right what has gone wrong. In the cross, we see that God takes upon himself the full burden of our inability to keep what he's said and opens up a new path that leads past death to new life. And in consummation, we see that the world as it is now is not going to stay this way, but God is actively at work renewing the world. One of the last things that God says in the Bible is in Revelation chapter 21, verse 5. And he says this, "Behold, I am making all things new." From creation to covenant to cross, we anticipate and we await the consummation where the risen Jesus out ahead of us will fully and finally redeem and reconcile what has been broken. We live in anticipation of God making all things new. But we at the same time look at the places where there's hurt and pain and recognize that because of the cross, God is present there. We live in response to the covenant, understanding that God creates us to not just await consummation, but to live right now in response to the good news, to demonstrate what it looks like to be a holy and faithful people. And we trust and see God in the creation, that God creates and sustains all that exists, and that he calls it good. So my final question is then, what difference does this make, understanding this story? You see, John is on the island of Patmos, and Jesus appears to him. And because John understands that God is the covenant God who claims his people even when they don't claim him, that God is the God of the cross who goes to those on the margins, that God has, that the risen Jesus has promised to bring to completion that which he started. John knows to look for Jesus even when he's abandoned, even when he's a prisoner of the state, even when he's without Christian community. When he's in this dark place, John knows to look for Jesus. You see, if we live in light of this story, we learn to expect and anticipate different kinds of things. If we are formed by this biblical story, we just might see Jesus when he appears to us. We just might have the language to describe what it is that we see. But I think a good modern example, a recent example, is in 2006, this Amish community in Pennsylvania, there was a school shooting. A gunman came into an Amish school, held 10 girls captive, held 13 girls captive, shot 10 of them, 5 of whom died. And almost immediately, the Amish community, who, because of their Christian understanding, have a commitment to nonviolence. Almost immediately, the Amish community reached out to the family of the gunman who ended up committing suicide himself. And he had a son. They reached out to the family of the gunman and offered their forgiveness and set up a foundation for this son who has this son and this widow who had been abandoned by this father. And invited the widow, one of the few outsiders that was invited to the funerals for these children, was the widow of this gunman. And the national news media had no category for what was going on. They just could not comprehend why a community would offer forgiveness so quickly. The guy hadn't apologized. Why should they offer this? Why should they go the extra mile in trying to reconcile? It makes no sense. But you see, here was a community that understood God as creator. One of the things that a leader said to the media as they were being confronted by this is simply, you know, this person who did this awful deed is now standing before a just God. We're not called to be judges. They understood God as creator. They also understood themselves as a covenant people, that they are called to a different ethic, a different kind of framework, a different imagination for how the world works. And so if they can't be a reconciled and reconciling people, then who can? And so out of a sense of covenant, they reached out. But they also understood the cross, that the world is a place of pain and unfairness and brokenness, and yet God claims us in the midst of it. And so because of Jesus on the cross, they knew that they could expect crosses as well. And so they sat with this pain. They could look into it because God is there even on the cross. But in the end, they did this because of their hope in the future. That God is the one actively making all things new. And so our ethic, the way we live, is not out of some sense of what's happened in the past, but out of our hope in what the future is. And the picture of the future is God reconciling those who are divided. And so we should be a reconciled and reconciling people. Friends, out of their framing of the world according to the biblical story, because the biblical story had so formed them, they were able to do something that's almost unimaginable and in a way be good news. Let us be a people who more and more know the story so that we can recognize Jesus when he appears. Let us also be a people who can live in an alternative, radical kind of way because we have been formed by this story.